Okay, shall we delve in? Thank you very much, Maxine, for all these announcements. And let's get going. We're getting towards, you know, I feel like we started with Eden and we worked our way quite far already. We're already at the last third of the book, but it's a big third. It's a big, chunky, difficult, complicated story that in many ways borrows or draws upon some of the themes and ideas we already saw, but complicates them, just ups the tension and shows us how they can become even more convoluted. We already saw in, we spoke about various kinds of relationships. We spoke about brotherhood. We spoke about parents and children. And of course, we spoke about spouses, people coming together to form families of their own. This was, in fact, the first relationship we spoke about when we spoke about Adam and Eve. And today we're coming back to that. We're coming back to romantic slash marital relationships. And we're coming to it with Jacob, with Yaakov, whose first year, as we discussed last week, when we discussed his relationships with his parents and more specifically with his brother, and whom we left last week when we finished the class, ejected from his childhood home. We heard that he's Vayetze. And we spoke about how the word Vayetze, and he went out, is the same word that's used to describe the birth of Esav, for example, or the moment when Isaac walks out and is becoming open to meeting Rebekah. There's a certain sense of leaving whatever formed you, whatever defined the horizons of your world behind, and setting out on a totally new kind of clean slate adventure. So we're watching Jacob leaving his parents and going out. And in many ways, while there's something exciting, I think, for all of us about clean slates and new beginnings and new adventures, it can also be very traumatic, especially when you're leaving home because your brother wants to kill you and you carry the guilt of having deceived your father to receive blessings that were not meant for you. But God doesn't let Jacob dwell in this feeling of, in this place of being lost and not knowing how to fit things together and not having a context within which his life makes sense. On the very night that Jacob goes out in his sleep, God reveals himself in a dream, the famous dream when Jacob dreams about a ladder attached to the ground that reaches all the way to the sky that has angels going up and down. And God talks to Jacob and says, I will be with you. Today, we're not going to focus on that. We're just starting there. And I want to show you something from last week's source sheet that we didn't get to. So I just think it's worth seeing it in the text. God intervenes. I'm here at box 11 of last week's source sheet. Just bear with me, please. And the Lord was standing beside him and he said, I am the Lord, the God of your father, Abraham, the God of Isaac. The ground on which you are lying, I will assign to you and to your offspring. Your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. These are all the promises that God already gave to Abraham and Isaac. So in a sense, what he's telling Jacob is, yes, the way you got the blessings may leave you wondering whether you deserve them or not, and whether they will come to pass or not, since you deceived your father to get it. But here I am, God, the source of all blessings, to tell you that, yes, I am placing you in the line that started with Abraham because I was his God, and Isaac because I was his God, and now I am talking to you, and I will give you the promises of land and descendants, which were the promises that I gave to your fathers, and no matter where you are, this will hold true. That's what he says in verse 15. Remember, I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. Immediately, Jacob's wandering, which until this point has the feeling of an escape to it, the feeling of an ejection, of an exile to it, receives a totally different context, a totally different interpretational framework. It's no longer a run for his life. It's a journey that's sanctioned by God and that God accompanies, God is present for. And when Jacob wakes up, he says something very, very telling that's relevant for our discussion today of Jacob's life following this moment. He says the following in verse 17. A moment. Shechem, he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the abode of God, and that is the gateway to heaven. He says, this is the home of God. And in this particular moment, the word home, later he names the place Beit El, literally the home of God. In this particular moment, the idea of a home, the idea that he's in a home, means more than this is a place where God dwells. This is the boy who's now leaving the broken home that lies in ruins behind him, that his childhood home, his childhood family. And now he's realizing that he is sharing a home with God. And this home supersedes everything that's happening in his life. This is a home that will remain true no matter what happens to his relationships, no matter if he's ejected from place to place, no matter if he's an exile. And suddenly, he has the confidence to keep going, knowing that no matter what he builds in his life moving forward, he is building it with God. He is building God's home, in a sense, a place where he and God can dwell together. And with that in mind, he goes on very much in search of a wife, as his father told him. He leaves his childhood home behind. He has the idea of a relationship with God, a home with God hovering above him. And the immediate task on hand is to build a new home, just like Adam and Eve, just like the Bible told us when Adam and Eve met, that this is the normal way of the world. Thus a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves unto his wife, and they become one flesh. And this is the moment when Jacob has to do that. Now, before we start and really look at details about the way he goes about it and the complications that evolve in his life, it's worth taking a step back and looking at this period in Jacob's life, the period where he meets his wives and marries them and starts having children and forms his complicated family, the family we just saw in Shul falling apart in the next generation. It's worth to look at it in the context of his life. Unlike both of his forefathers, both Abraham and Isaac, Jacob has no problem with fertility. Abraham had to wait and wait and wait and first have Ishmael, and then miraculously have Isaac. Isaac had to wait for 20 years and then had twins, and that's it, no more children. Jacob not only marries four women, he has 12 sons and a daughter, and he has them immediately. He may not have them from Rachel. Rachel is infertile for a long time, but he has children immediately. He has no problem forming a family. And yet, oddly enough, despite the fact that he's surrounded from this point forward by wives and children, there is something about Jacob's life that makes him appear, or something about the way he's described in the biblical narrative, that makes him appear extremely alone, extremely lonely. Abraham and Sarah were a power couple. We may disagree with some of their decisions. We may dislike some of their communications or Abraham's decision to present her as his sisters, et cetera, et cetera. But it's very clear that they both have a say with each other and that their partnership is strong and they're moving together through all the challenges of life. Isaac and Rebekah, as we already saw, had a complicated relationship, one that lacked communication to a great extent. They never talked with each other properly, but in which both of them played strong and powerful roles. Jacob's life, while being laden with wives and children, see him making decisions and dealing with things and handling situations on some level alone. His wives don't have the same say. They don't have the same power. When he will want to leave the house of Laban, his father-in-law, he will talk to them and they will agree to come with him. But this is the extent of their initiative, in a sense, in the shaping of his life. Aviva Zornberg, in a beautiful book about the subconscious as portrayed in the Bible, puts it in the following words. The shape of Jacob's history suggests a powerful paradox. Much married and father of many children, he lives many years single, palpably alone. His narrative conveys a sense of solitude and inwardness. More than anyone before him, he lives in a large register of turbulence, of error and reevaluation. He, alone of all patriarchs, leaves the Holy Land for an extended period of time. And even when he returns, heavy with family and possessions, he is pointedly described in the scene that accompanies his coming home as Levado, alone. And the famous scene when he meets the angel and fights with the angel, and it says that he's alone. This fight, the fight of his life, he does by himself. Though he is married to four wives, he has reverted to the condition of Adam before God created his helpmeet. Back when God said, Lo tov yot Adam, Levado, it's not good for men to be alone. And now Jacob is described as Levado, standing alone. Second, can I just ask it to, everybody silence, mute themselves, because I think there's some echoing. In this condition, he struggles with a man angel who changes his name. Then, strangely, and we'll get to that at the end of today's class, his wives disappear from the narrative. Alone, he endures the anguish of Joseph's loss. Unpartnered, he brings his children down to Egypt, and alone, he blesses them on his deathbed. Jacob's essential aloneness is palliated for a relatively brief segment of his life. At the end of Jacob's life, as we will see in 2 weeks, he stands before Pharaoh and talks very grimly about the life he had led. And the truth is, it was a long and turbulent life. There was the period at home with his parents and his brother, then the period in exile when he went to Laban's house and worked for his wife's hands and for his family. Then there was coming back and having the whole struggle with Shechem when his daughter is kidnapped. Then there will be the scene where his sons are rivals and one of his sons, his most beloved son, is sold down to slavery. Then years later, he himself moves to Egypt. Throughout this entire long arc, there's about 20 years or so, maybe a little less, in which his wives play a role of any significance. They're no longer real partners for him after he settles back in the land of Canaan. For example, we will see next week the moment of the kidnapping and rape of his daughter. We see how he responds. We see how his sons respond. We have no idea how any of his wives respond. Later, when we hear about Joseph, we have no idea if the wives are even alive to respond in any way whatsoever. We see them moving to Egypt. We have no idea how the wives figure into it. We don't hear them. They're not present. And what we're going to do today, as we look at the different stages or at the beginnings of Jacob's forming his family and then at the complications that follow this beginning, we will try and answer the question, why? Why is it that a man who forms partnerships, who loves at least one of his wives, who has children, does not acquire a partnership of the heart? Does not acquire the kind of partnership that can sustain him throughout his life and mitigate this deep aloneness that he carries in his story. Our course is about relationships in Tanakh, so to frame it more broadly, I would say that our question today is, how come a person who has so many significant relationships with his wives and children is still very much isolated within himself? We will look for these answers in the beginning, just like we did in Isaac and Rebecca's case, where we tried to see how their beginning reveals and foreshadows what follows. Here, too, we will start with the beginning of the formation of Jacob's marital relationships and see what hidden cues or keys to the future we can discover here. So let's look at it together. It all starts after Jacob finishes his journey from Canaan to Haran. And he reaches to this new country where his mother's brother lives and where he hopes to marry a woman that would please his parents, who do not want, who would like him to marry back into the family. So let's read it together. I'm here at box 2 in the source sheet if you have it printed. Jacob resumed his journey resumed after the dream about the ladder, and came to the land of the Easterners. There, before his eyes, was a well in the open. In Hebrew, it says basadeh, in the field. Three flocks of sheep were lying there besides it, for the flocks were watered from that well. The stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the stone would be rolled from the mouth of the well and the sheep watered. Then the stone would be put back in its place on the mouth of the well. But he doesn't see that. That's just the editor, the storyteller intervenes to explain to us why they're all waiting there instead of just taking off the rock and letting their flocks drink. What he sees is all these flocks, all these shepherds, just sitting there at a time when the sun is still up and the sheep could gain more nutrition by going to eat more, by going to graze more. And he speaks up. Jacob said to them, "My friends, where are you from?" And they said, "We are from Haran." In Hebrew, it's two words, Micharan Banu. And in Hebrew, it also says, he doesn't call them my friends, he calls them my brothers. Achai, me'ayin atem, v'yomu Micharan Banu. Verse 5, he said to them, "Do you know Lavan, the son of Nachor?" And they said, "Yes, we do." In Hebrew, it's one word, yadanu. That's all they say. They don't elaborate, "Oh, he's a nice guy. Oh, he's a devious guy. Oh, you can find him if you go three tents to the east and then up the road, etc." They just say, "Yes, we do." He continued, "Is he well? Hashalom lo." They answered, "Yes, he is. And there is his daughter, Rachel, coming with a flock." I want to point out, until this point, what we see is a certain disparity between Jacob's overtures and the responses of the shepherds. He keeps speaking with a verbose kind of choice of words. He keeps giving them openings for a conversation. But the impression we get is that the shepherds, time and time again, give the shortest possible answer. Until the answer they can tell him is, "Oh, here's someone you can talk to," which in the context appears to mean, "Oh, good, you can stop harassing us. You can go and talk to her. She will answer your questions." And this is interesting. It's an interesting way of shaping the story. It portrays Jacob as someone who wants to be friends, who calls them his brothers. Of course, we will come back to this word later because the word brother is very potent in Jacob's life. And the locals are not exactly welcoming. Now Jacob pays them back in a sense, or pays them back the same coin by questioning them, questioning their decisions, offering them a critique. I'm going to verse 7. He said, "It is still broad daylight, too early to round up the animals. Water the flock and take them to pasture." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are rounded up. Then the stone is rolled off the mouth of the well and we water the sheep." While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's flock, for she was a shepherdess. We will go back and reread this now and find all kinds of things in it. But before we reread it, I want to move a little bit forward and see what happens when Jacob sees Rachel. Because what happens is a moment of inspiration, a moment when he's overwhelmed with initiative. I'm looking here at box 3. "And when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Laban, and the flock of his uncle Laban, Jacob went up and rolled the stone off the mouth of the well and watered the flock of his uncle Laban. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and broke into tears." So many verbs following right after the other. Vayigash Yaakov, vayagel, vayashk, vayishak, vayisa, vayevch. 6 verbs in Hebrew. It reminds us much, I'll put it this way. It's more in keeping with Esav's style. Last week we read the verse where Esav sells the right of the firstborn and eats the red stew and stands up and feels disdain when he thinks about the right of the firstborn and walks away. And there too, it's a verse that has many, many, many verbs strung together very tightly, conveying the sense of restless action, of someone who's constantly in motion, constantly doing things. It also reminds us of Rebecca, who we first met running around by a different well, perhaps the same well, actually, when Abraham's slave asked her for a little bit of water, and she says, of course, I'll give you water, but also your camels. And she runs, 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 and brings him water and hurries up. And when she hears that he wants to stay with her family, she runs back home to tell her father about it. And she's in action, in action, in action throughout her life. As she meets Isaac, she takes the veil, she covers herself, she falls off the camel, she talks to the slave. As she sees her husband about to bless the wrong son, in her opinion, she goes and talks to Jacob and prepares food for him to bring to Isaac and wraps his hands in furs and tells him, do it, and whatever happens, the consequences are on me. If he curses you, I'll be to blame. Time and time again, we see a seven Rebecca like this. Until this moment, we don't see Jacob acting so much. We see him contemplating. We see him responding. But we don't see him in such a state of heightened activity until now. And this heightened activity highlights not only that this encounter changes something in him, it also heightens the fact that Rachel, in contrast to him, is very, very passive. All we see about Rachel is that she comes there. And later, when he tells her who he is, she goes home to tell her father about him. But while Jacob is busy rolling rocks and giving kisses and weeping tears, we have no idea what Rachel is doing. We have no idea what she's thinking. We have no idea what she's saying. She is a blank canvas for us. And yet, as we will see when we read onwards, Jacob already at this moment not only feels, not only is inspired to act, he also comes to love her with the word vayohavota, like is actually used, the word for love. So the question it raises for us, or should raise for us, is this: how can he love her without knowing her? There's nothing in this scene that indicates anything about Rachel's personality. There's nothing in this scene that expresses who she is, what she cares about, what she thinks about the events evolving around her, whether she too has any feelings. There's nothing. And yet Jacob comes to love her. And this is the first thing I wanted to draw your attention to as a possible answer as to why Jacob is doomed to this deep, pervasive loneliness. Because love doesn't preclude the need. It doesn't mean that we no longer need communication. You can love someone without truly knowing them. And Jacob throws himself into this love for Rachel, but there's a huge gap between her and him, or her as he sees her, or as he desires her, and whoever it is she is on the inside. And one day down the line, after events will catch up with him, after he will be promised Rachel in marriage, work for 7 years, and then be given Leah, deceived by his father-in-law into marrying Leah instead, literally having her snuck into his wedding ceremony without his knowledge. Then he will agree to work for another 7 years for Rachel. He will marry Rachel. And then he will start having children with Leah, one child after the other, while Rachel is infertile. And when Rachel will watch this, will watch her sister having all those babies, one after the other, after the other, after the other, she will speak in a way that will clearly catch Jacob by surprise. For just a moment, I think I have it here. Here, I'm in box 10, all the way down. When Rachel saw that she had borne Jacob no children, she became envious of her sister. And Rachel said to Jacob, give me children or I shall die. Hava li banim v'im ayin meta anochi. It's a very deep statement. a little bit like Esav's statement when he said that he's about to die, so what good is the right of the firstborn for him? Which perhaps appeared like a petulant, oh, I'm dying, I'm starving, what does it matter to me? But when you think about it, could stand for a deep philosophical stance, in a sense, where he says, we all die in the end, the future doesn't matter, what matters is the carpe diem of the present. In a similar way, we can read what Rachel says in this scene as this kind of histrionics of a distressed woman saying, I'll die if you don't have children. But if you take a step back and think about it, what she's really telling Jacob is, without children, I'm not going to be continued. There's not going to be progeny. My death will be final. The only way that we as humans have of acquiring some sort of permanence past death is through the children we leave behind us, or through works of learning, works of art. But I don't think any of those ways were available to a woman in that society at that time. What is available to her, what gives meaning to her life, what gives her a name that will outlive her, is the children she leaves behind her. And without them, one day, sooner or later, she'll die and there's nothing going to be left from her. So she says, give me children or I will die and my death will be final. But when Jacob hears this, what we see is a deep sense of misalignment. He doesn't get it. He's not responding with compassion. He's not responding with understanding. Instead, he's angry. Let's look at verse 2. Jacob was incensed, vaichal af Yaakov, at Rachel and said, can I take the place of God who has denied you fruit of the womb? The you here is very pointed. It's kind of a cruel you. It's the you of a man who has many children with his other wife. And he says, it's you. God decided not to give you children. Why are you turning to me? I'm not God. I have children. You're the problem. And then if we try and unpack this moment, if we try and think, what does he mean? What does he feel? Again, it's easy to dismiss what he says as just a cruel answer, as the anger of an insensitive husband. But imagine being in Jacob's shoes. Imagine being a man who loves a woman very dearly and works 14 years just for the right of marrying her. And apparently doesn't care that she doesn't have children. He's just happy to have her as his wife. And then she tells him, you know, this life that we share, that you wanted so much, that you worked so hard for, it's meaningless for me if I don't have children. It's like death for me. So I think what we see is a woman who feels very unhappy and a man who's feeling rejected. And it's especially poignant when you see her response, because she's not responding to his deeper pain. She is still only focused on the children issue. So she comes up with a practical solution. She said, here is my maid Bilhah. Consort with her that she may bear on my knees and that through her, I too may have children. Now, if you're a husband who already feels insecure because his beloved wife feels that life with you without children is worthless and it's like death, how would you feel if she then says, please have marital relationships with another woman? Because what I care about is the children that will come, not about your communion with yet another woman in your life. In these three condensed verses, we see where this disparity between Jacob, who's inspired into love, and Rachel, who is totally unrevealed to us and presumably to him, leads to. It leads to a place where what they want is not the same thing. What they care about is not the same thing. And when the moment of truth comes, we see that they're misaligned in terms of what they actually care about, what's most important to them. But we can't see that in the beginning because Rachel doesn't speak at all. Now, I saw somebody asked in one of the comments, I don't have time to respond to everything, but somebody asked, so would I characterize Jacob's response as more infatuation than love? I'm hesitant of making that judgment. because the biblical storyteller doesn't use the word love lightly. Obviously, the word love as it's used in the Bible is not the same as the word love we use today to describe romantic relationships. The history of how people understand love and what love means to them saw so many changes and fundamental changes at that, that we can't really use the language and expect it to mean exactly the same thing. But it is the word that we heard from Isaac when Isaac came to love Rebekah. It is the word that we will hear way, way, way down the line when Michal, daughter of King Shaul, will come to love her husband David and save him, choose him over her father's interests. It's a word that means something. So when we hear that Jacob loves Rachel, I don't want to just dismiss it and say, oh, he's just feeling passion. It's not really love. It's just infatuation and passion. But I do want to say that it's a love that is lacking in communication. It's not the first love like that we saw. Isaac and Rebecca also, we saw love without communication. There, it led to the climax in the scene where Rebecca coached Jacob into stealing the blessings that Isaac meant to his brother. Here, it will lead to a sense of alienation, a sense of misalignment between Jacob and Rachel. But that doesn't preclude the idea that there could be good times between them and good feelings and strong, real feelings between them. Setting that aside, I want to go back to the same scene and point out another running theme or a hidden narrative within it. Not only is the scene presenting Jacob as very, very active and inspired into action while Rachel is silent and passive, it also carries a very gentle hint to Jacob as somehow disrupting the order. We see that the shepherds have a certain system in place. The system is that everybody waits until everybody's together and then they remove the stone. Some commentators said, oh, it just shows that they're lazy. They should have worked harder and removed the stone and given water to the sheep and then taken the sheep back to graze. And that would have been the appropriate thing to do because these are hired shepherds. They have a responsibility to their employers to take good care of the sheep. And by sitting there by the well and waiting around, they're not carrying out their responsibility. But we can also read it differently. Rabbi Elchanan Samet from Israel offers a different reading. He says, perchance, what we're seeing here is a system of insurance. What we're seeing here is a society where water is an extremely important resource. And there's the real question of maybe somebody will abuse this resource and take all of it or take more of it than they deserve, more than a first share. And therefore, by putting that enormous heavy rock on the well, the shepherds ensure that not one of them will be able to take it off by himself and steal all the water or an unduly large amount of water. And the reason they're waiting is not because they're lazy. It's rather because they're trying to keep things equitable. They're trying to keep things fair. And then when Jacob comes in and basically ignores all of that and rolls off the stone and lets Rachel drink, even though she's the last to come. She's not the shepherds who've been waiting there for quite a while. She's the last to come, but he gives her water first. He is not offering fair criticism of their laziness. He is rather disrupting their system of ensuring justice within their society. We can argue whether the system is good or bad, right or wrong. It's definitely clear that Jacob comes and he's a disruptive presence. Chazal, sages, caught onto this hidden hint of disruption. And they interpret Jacob's tears. We see here in verse 11 that he kisses Rachel and then breaks into tears. He raises a voice and cries in the words in Hebrew. And they interpret those tears in ways that shed a light or put the spotlight, in a sense, on Jacob's, how should I put it, on the places where Jacob doesn't fit in, on the places where he is disrupting the way things should be or doesn't fit into the system of the way things are. Here, let's look at it together. Here, I'm in box 5. It's from Bereshit Rabbah 70. Why did he weep? And they offer 3 answers. Answer number 1. He said, at the time that Eliezer brought Rebekah, what is written about it? And the servant took 10 camels, etc. Eliezer came laden with gifts for the family of the bride. But I did not take a single nose ring nor a single bracelet. In other words, there he is without the bride price, without any gifts, without any of the things that a suitor should have in this world. And he loves her. He wants her. But his love is not clad in the appropriate procedures. He doesn't have it within him to offer the normal procedures. This is why he's going to have to work for her, because he doesn't have money to pay. Another explanation. Why did he weep? As he saw that she would not be buried with him. This is the meaning of that which is written, that he said to Leah, hence he will lay with you tonight, etc., etc. Jacob looks at this woman. He feels immediate emotions. He comes to love her, but he can see that on some level, their union is not complete. Their union is going to fall apart. They're not going to always be together. They're not going to build a kind of life where they live together, die together, are buried together. There's something in their union that cannot be. Or the third explanation, why did he weep? As he saw people whispering to one another because he kissed her. Why is this one coming to introduce a new matter of licentiousness? And the Midrash goes on to explain that from the time of the flood, the people of the world took a stand to forbid themselves licentiousness. And then when they see Jacob come and kiss a girl whom we've just met on the mouth, presumably, right out there in front of all of them, they think that there's something licentious, there's something evil, there's something disruptive, something that disrupts the order, as we discussed when we talked about the flood and about how licentiousness disrupts the order. There's something that disrupts the order to a dangerous point in his behavior. Now, excuse me. Sorry, I apologize. The sages are reading into it. They're opening the story wide and pulling on strands that we could argue whether they're here in the simple story or not. But the fact stands that Jacob certainly breaks things. He certainly behaves in a way that breaks expectations, that breaks the rhythm, that breaks whatever was the rule of the place. Later, after his father-in-law will give him the wrong wife, Leah, who's the eldest daughter, instead of Rachel, who's the youngest, Laban is even going to put words to this general feeling that Jacob's behavior doesn't fit the conventions of the time, the conventions of the place. He's going to say, I am here in box 6, and I'm going to jump a little bit. You know what? I'll read the whole thing. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my time is fulfilled, that I may cohabit with her. And Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a feast. In other words, he takes Jacob's love and he says, okay, now let's put it in the right ornaments, in the right clothes, in the right context, the social context where the society celebrates the love and the marriage. Except the feast is used to cheat Jacob. When evening came, he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and he cohabited with her. When morning came, there was Leah. He thought it's Rachel, but it's Leah instead. So he said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me? And here Laban phrases the rules of the place. Laban said, it is not the practice in our place to marry off the youngest before the eldest. First, the older girl has to marry, and only then can the younger girl marry. Now, I'm not trying to pretend that what Laban does here is fair. The fact is he only says it now and not earlier. He clearly used Jacob's desire, Jacob's love for Rachel, to get work out of him. And now he uses the same love to get 7 more years of work out of him. I'm not trying to justify it by any means. But I do want to point out that what Laban says doesn't ring false in itself. The idea that society would expect the eldest daughter to marry before the youngest is something that we see through millennia. If you're well-versed in Pride and Prejudice, there's some references to this very idea in Pride and Prejudice from the 19th century. So it's not exactly an odd requirement. It's actually quite common in the history of the world. And yet Jacob, with his love, doesn't care for these frameworks. He wants something else. His love is subversive of expectations. This characteristic, this strand of subversiveness in Jacob's love brings to the fore a very deep truth about the way emotions in general and love in particular play different roles in society. There is no question that love is a constructive force in the world, in the sense that love brings people together, forms families, creates the chances for continuity of the human race. Families are considered a stabilizing force historically. Not only do they produce children, but they create order and stability in a society. And they build the world. They create the world. They expand the world. At the same time, all you have to do is turn on your TV and look at any TV show to see that love also plays a destructive role when it comes to social norms and conventions. All the great love stories, or I shouldn't say all, but many of the great love stories at their core are a story about people who love each other, even though they shouldn't according to social norms. I mentioned Pride and Prejudice. Mr. Darcy is far too high born and well connected to come to love low born and poor Elizabeth Bennet. But you go to story after story after story and you see that the core of the story is this tension between society, social expectations, social norms, and love, which empowers people to act against them. And this is what love does to Jacob. Love comes into Jacob's life as a force that breaks the norms, breaks the expectations. And perhaps part of the answer to the question we started with, the question of why he is a lonely man at its core, at its heart, perhaps this, the truth of the destructive nature of his love, the fact that his love is so rebellious, so much immersed in a refusal to accept reality as it is, the key might lie there. Because ironically, this is not what Rachel wants. Rachel, the woman whom he loves with all this, I wouldn't go as far as to say illicit, but unconventional power of emotion, wants the most conventional, constructive, society-building, socially approved things of all. She wants children, specifically sons. She wants sons. She doesn't want this great love affair. She doesn't want him to move rocks. Perhaps she does. Maybe it was useful at the moment. But what she really wants is that which is considered socially her role in life, in this society, which is to give birth to male children. And thus, Jacob's love that is so rooted in unconventionality dooms him to a deeper misalignment with Rachel. Because that's not the life she wants. This is not the life she desires. And the truth is, it leads us to another deeper layer that runs through this passage. We keep rereading the passage of his first encounter with Rachel. There's another deeper presence here that complicates matters even farther. In order to see this presence, let's go look at it again. What's the first word that Jacob says in this scene? The first word that Jacob says in this scene is, "Echai, my brothers, where are you from?" The word brother rings very loud in this scene because Jacob is coming here fresh on the heels of cheating his brother out of his inheritance, out of his blessings. And he is coming there to a great extent because his brother wants to kill him. And it's almost a Freudian slip that he starts with this word, that this word is the first that comes to mind. But that's not the only presence or the only shadow that Esav casts on this scene. What does he see? When Jacob comes, what does he see? He sees a well in the field, Sadeh. The field is the place that's continuously associated with Esav. Esav is the man of the field. He's the man who was out in the field, whose clothes smell of the field. In the scene of stealing, of pretending to be his brother Esav, Isaac asks Jacob to come and says, "Reach bni ki reach hasadeh." Smell of my son is the smell of the field. And this is how he recognizes him as Esav, even though he acknowledges that the voice is the voice of Jacob. The smell is strong enough. It's Esavish, Esavesk, if you wish, enough to be a strong enough indicator that this is his eldest son, Esav. And this is what Jacob sees. What people see in the Bible tells us something about themselves. It's almost as if he sees a shadow of his brother at this moment. And then the word he speaks is, "My brother." And then eventually, when he hugs and kisses, when he kisses Rachel, the next thing he does is he weeps. Vayisa'et kolo vayev. The last person we saw described in exactly these words was Esav upon learning that Jacob stole his blessing. It's already the storyteller, not Jacob, that creates a parallel between them. It's as if in this moment, Jacob acts out Esav's role. He's enacting. Not only is he active and uses a lot of verbs, acts with many verbs like his brother, he's also crying just like his brother did earlier on. It's even more highlighted to us, this connection between Jacob and Esav, or Esav's shadowy presence, in other parts of the text. We don't have time to look at all of it, but the whole story is framed with a constant emphasis on the fact that Jacob is going to the house of his mother's brother, and that his mother had two sons. And there's just constantly this kind of attention being gently drawn to the family he came from. Instead of focusing on the family he's building, as the text overtly does, there's so many subversive small hints to the family he's coming from and what he's carrying with him and the memory he's carrying with him. We started by saying that building a family is what happens to Jacob after his vayetzeh goes out from his birth family. But what we see in this scene is that, in fact, you can't disconnect the two. His birth family comes with him. The memories, the connections, associations of his brother, of his feud with his brother, cast their shadow over this new chapter in his life. And the sages, in their reading of the subsequent events of Jacob's relationship with Leah and Jacob's relationship with Rachel, emphasize this presence. They emphasize Esav's presence. For example, they have this beautiful description. We're not going to read it. It's in your source sheet, but I'm just going to share it with you like this, where they say that throughout the marriage night, the wedding night, when Jacob has marital relations with Leah, he kept saying, "Rachel," and she said, "Yes." And Rachel, and Leah says, "Yes." And in the morning, he said, "You're a deceiver, daughter of a deceiver. Didn't I say the wrong name? And you responded as if it's really you." And she said, "Excuse me, who do you think I learned it from? Didn't your father, when he was giving the blessing, say Esav? And you say, 'Yes.' And he said, 'Esav.' And you said, 'Yes.' In other words, you are my model. My marriage with you is a continuation of the same act that you perpetrated upon your own father. This is, of course, the sage's way of drawing attention to the beautiful measure for measure element here, to this kind of karmic balance that we see here, where Jacob, who deceived his father for his identity, is now deceived through his wife's identity. But I think there's more than that. It's as if Esav is present in the room with the two of them. It's his memory is present in the room with the two of them. And the sages go further. And this is really where we're going here. This is where I'd like to tie all the strands of what we discussed today together. The sages go even further and say that there's a reason, a divine reason, why God favored Leah with sons. And in fact, made it so that her son became, Yehuda became the leaders eventually, became the firstborn, got the right of leadership of the firstborn eventually. And the reason is tied to her description of someone with soft eyes. They said that, the sages tell us this story, that growing up, Leah would go and sit on the crossroads where travelers come from other countries. And time again, she would hear them saying, oh, look, Rebecca has two sons, and Lavan, her brother, has two daughters. So the eldest son should marry the eldest daughter, and the youngest son should marry the youngest daughter. And she asked those travelers, so tell me about this eldest son. What is he like? And they all said, oh, he's a dangerous man. He's a bandit. He's a violent man. And she said, what about the young son? Oh, he's a soft-spoken, good, righteous man. And she would cry and cry and cry for her fate that she's destined to marry the older Esav. With this midrash in line, let's reapproach the fact that Jacob ends up married to both of these sisters. Because in a way, it's a natural continuation of the process that started when he walked into his father's room with furs on his hands, pretending to be Esav. Back then, what he wanted was the blessings that his father meant for his brother. And in order to do that, he needed to assume a part of Esav's identity, the hands. His voice remained different, but he had to try and adopt enough of Esav for it to be believable so that the blessings would come to him. What happens once the consequences of that eject him from his home, force him to fend for himself and have to maneuver and outmaneuver a deceptive father-in-law, deal with a reality where he is the outsider and the exile, work and fight for everything he will eventually own. In other words, what follows is him having to try and become not merely Jacob, the man of the tent, but also Esav, the man of the outdoors, the strong warrior, the man who stands for himself. He has to become enough like Esav to survive his father-in-law household and his own exile. And it is appropriate that he, the man who took Esav's hands by putting furs and took Esav's blessing and destiny as his father saw it, ends up also with the wife who was destined for his brother, which is Leah. And then his marriage situation, the complication between him and his wife, becomes more than just the kind of somewhat tragic life of one man encumbered with complicated relationships. It becomes also another variation on the same theme that runs throughout his life, the theme of having to become or to outgrow the Jacob who held onto Esav's heel and was a man of the tent. Only after his marriages, only after his experiences with Lavan, can Jacob come back home, stand up to his brother, part ways peacefully, and defeat an angel, thus earning himself a name that finally frees him from being the man who holds his father's, his brother's heel and is named after it, Jacob, Yaakov, who holds the heel, Akev. Only then does he become Israel, the man who fights with men and angels and survives. Only then does he outgrow being the kind of quiet, soft-spoken, non-military twin. And in order to do that, he needs to live this complicated life with all its marriages. Once we understand that, once we understand that the real struggle of his life is not with Lavan, it's not with Leah, it's not with Rachel and her desires that don't align with his. Once we understand that the real struggle of his life is to become a combination of himself and his brothers, to outgrow the brother he used to be, is to become enough like Esav that he can stand on his own right as a full man and earn the blessings he received under a borrowed, assumed, stolen name. Once we understand that, it's easier to understand why his wife stepped off the stage of the focal point of the story when they do. Because once he meets Esav, once he sorts out this big struggle of his life, once he sets it enough aside, his wife stopped serving the role of his learning experience, his growth experience, and the lonely man who stands on his own right emerges in a sense isolated or alienated from them beyond this point. We see this, I want to show you in the text, in his meeting with Esav, when he says, when Esav sees him and asks, I'm at the very last box, in box 11, and I'm going to jump straight to verse 5. Looking about, he, that is Esav, saw the women and the children. Who, he asked, are these with you? Note that Esav notices the women before the children. But what Jacob says is, he answered, the children with whom God has favored your servant. The sages suggest that he said it because he wanted to draw Esav's attention away from his wives, because he was wary of Esav's intentions. But this also marks the point where his wife stopped being a focal point in his life. Now that he resolved things with his brothers, his wives too fade into the background, with one exception, and the exception is very telling. The exception is Rachel's death. And it's a death that's very tragic because we don't see Jacob consoling her. We don't see some great moment of reconciliation or meeting of the souls. Instead, we see her giving one name to her son and him giving another name to his son and burying her and moving on. And from that point on, the wives recede into the background. There's one point I want to make about Leah. So if you can bear with me for another minute, I'll make this point and then I'll take some questions. I said before that there's a misalignment between what Rachel wants and what Jacob wants. That Jacob wants her for unconventional reasons, for emotional reasons. He wants her for love. And she wants the conventional, the conventional child-bearing and child-rearing existence. That's what she wants from him. But the truth is that if we take seriously the reading of the sages and what they read into Leah's past, her history of crying and praying not to have to marry Esav, but rather to marry the young son who isn't meant for her, we can see that there's also a deep misalignment between her and Jacob. For Jacob, she is the mother of his children. She is the woman who easily and plentifully supplies him male heirs and even his one daughter. But for him, for her, he is the husband she chose against social expectations. She is the husband she shouldn't have married. She should have married Esav, according to the sages. But she chose him for her own purposes that have nothing to do with the expectation of the society around her, that have to do with what her values, her inner world is. So she wants him for the unconventional, and he lives with her and gets the conventional from her. And he looks at her sister and wants something unconventional with Rachel, while Rachel looks at him and looks at her sister and wants the conventional. Each person in this relationship does not want what the object of their desire wants. With that in mind, thank you so much. whoever has to leave, thank you so much for being here. I can't take all the questions. I'll take some. And of course, since we're going to stay with Jacob next week, even though we'll focus more on his children, if you have any question that you feel I didn't address and need addressing, please add it in the chat next week as well. A moment. Bimir asks a question. Does the dwelling place or abode of God, the land God is giving Yaakov, does that promise extend to any place that he is? Is there's a problem in my text here. Is any location a person lives focusing on God can be a place where God dwells? So there's an interesting ambiguity there in what Jacob says, because he seems to be speaking about this particular location, not even the land of Israel in general, this particular place, Beit El, as the house of God. And yet the fact is that he talks about having a relationship with God throughout his life. And he makes a certain, his focus is very much on returning to the land of his father, but it's also very clear that he sees God as being with him, and God says he will be with him wherever he is. So I would argue that while this physical location matters, what Jacob is starting here is a lifetime of partnership with God that can outlast not one exile in his personal case, but two. A moment. Suri Rudolf points out that Yaakov mirrors Rebecca, and Rebecca's actions mirror Abraham. And the truth is this, meaning by the well, Jacob behaves like Rebecca did by a well. And when Rebecca did, she acted in ways that were reminiscent of the way Abraham did. So what, it's a good observation. Thank you, Suri. And it's especially powerful because Rabbi Jonathan Grossman, in a beautiful book about Jacob, points out that Jacob undergoes many of the same trials that Abraham did. It's almost as if he's repeating Abraham's life. He's repeating Abraham's trials. Rabbi Grossman thinks it's part of a broader theme, which is that because Jacob took the blessings and had to leave home, the kind of natural growth that started from Avram to Yitzhak and should have reached a crescendo with him needs to be restarted. He needs to once again repeat Abraham's journey from Haran to the land of Israel, repeat the experience of almost losing a son, repeat a lot of the experiences to reestablish the covenant that was ruptured when he was ejected from his home because of his enmity with Esav. But the difference is that in Avraham's case, God is very involved. God is the one who tells him, go here, go there, sacrifice your son, do that. In Jacob's life, it's his family relationships that fulfill God's role in Abraham's life. Moment.
Well, just a moment.
Somebody pointed out, compare Rachel and Dinah. Rachel is a shepherdess out in the world. It seems a mostly male world. And she meets her husband who, after the initial contact, pun intended, has great patience and restraint. And Rachel, while working, coming to the well to water a flock and meets Jacob with what happens to Dinah. It's a very good point. And by the way, I think if I'm not mistaken, the sages or the commentators use the fact that Rachel so clearly, fearlessly walks around the male shepherds and isn't accosted by them to strengthen their case for saying that what the shepherds are displeased at when Jacob kisses her is that the shepherds think there's something inappropriate. And that's why Jacob is embarrassed and cries, because the way he is seen, the way his action, which is stemming from pure and powerful emotion, is seen by others is as a violation of some sort. Woman.
Can I ask something?
Sure, of course. Ruhama, is that you?
Yes. Not that it's so. On Kriyat Shema, before we go to sleep, we say, Yamalecha goelotim, Yevarech Hashem Avraham ve'Yitzchak, And Yaakov is not mentioned. And I was wondering, you remember
he's the speaker.
נערים וקרא בהם שמי שם אבותי אברהם ויצחק ויתגול הרוב בקרב הארץ. And Yaakov is not mentioned here. I was just wondering. Yeah, this is one thing. And another thing, when we are talking about Yaakov and the name, if somebody gives a name Yaakov, it's not such a compliment, you know, this name. But Yitzchak, I see, is different than all of them, because from the Akedah, he was damaged for life. Mm-hmm. He's the only one that did not leave Israel. He's the only one. So he was really damaged. So this is different. From all the three of them, Abraham looks the perfect, so to speak. And mm-hmm. And each one of Yitzchak and Yaakov have their own
mission
and problems.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, about the bracha that we say, the Elokei Avotai Avraham Yitzchak, the reason Jacob is not mentioned is because it's a quote of Jacob. Jacob is the speaker. It's him talking. He says, and then we'll get to that at the end of our course. This is at the very end of our course. We will see Jacob blessing his grandchildren, and that's the words he uses to bless them. So, and which is very appropriate if you think about it, because it's not just that, oh, okay, so he's a speaker, so he's not mentioned. It's not just that. Jacob is the one that started a nation. Abraham, one of his sons, was not part of the nation. Lot was not part of the covenant. Isaac, one of his sons, was not part of the covenant. Jacob is the first one who passes on the covenant to his entire family. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're called Bnei Israel, not Bnei Avraham and Bnei Yitzchak, because that's what distinguishes us. We are all the children of Israel. We're the totality of his children, or his sons, to be more accurate. We don't exactly know what happens to Dinah. So when we say this bracha, it's very appropriate, because it's like we adopt Israel's voice.
I see.
We are speaking as him. Now, in terms of the comparison between Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and how they're all different, there's no question that Yitzchak is unique. Abraham and Jacob have to go through exile and discover God and fight and lose things and go through a very turbulent life in different ways. Whereas Yitzchak doesn't. But I wouldn't say that you can read it as damaged, or you can read it as he's a follower. His job is to take his father's teaching and make them into a way of life. And that's very hard to do if you're also struggling with your own changes and new things and original things. So you can read it one way or another.
Yes, he's the only one that even couldn't find a wife for himself, but they had to send mm-hmm. somebody else to find for him a wife.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, yes. It was really...
He serves a different role. He serves a very, very different role in our national memory. That's definitely true. Here, I'd like to read a question from Gershon Hepner. Thank you, Ruchama, for these good comments, these enlightening comments. In contrast to Jacob, about whom we read, Vayvater Yaakov Levado, that he remained alone when he fought the angel, Joseph got into trouble by having yichud, by being alone with Potiphar's wife. For him, as for Adam, being alone is not good. Right. That's an interesting observation. Thank you. That there's aloneness can be existential, or it can be sometimes it can be a moment of danger. Let's put it this way. Women are in danger when they walk out of their house. Men are in danger when they're alone with someone. Just a moment. Somebody commented, Jacob and uncle Lavan, Avraham and nephew Lot. Torah does not have stories about uncles and nephews getting along, but yes, concern, taking nephews in or fighting to free them or help them escape from danger. It's an interesting observation that, uncle and nephew are complicated relationships. In Tanakh, it's particularly interesting if you compare it in the book of Shoftim. There's a son of Gideon. Gideon was a great judge and he had 70 children. And one of his sons wants to kill all the others. And he gets his uncles to help him, his uncles on the maternal side. except eventually he ends up killing his uncles too. So it's an interesting way to round up that example. Gershom Hapner wrote, as I show in my book, Legal Friction, the Dudaim that Leah gets from Reuven are the Adoma Adoma Zeh that Esav gets from Yaakov. Oh, that's really beautiful. Thank you. That there's a certain connection there, a certain parallel later that Leah gives, sells Rachel the Dudaim, just as Jacob sold Esav the red stew. I'm going to...
Actually, King David was also Admoni in Yefeinayim.
That's right. The color red is definitely also connected to David. There's some excellent comments and questions that I do not, I'm afraid, have time to address now. I want to thank all of you. Thank you. Your questions and comments are always a big part and definitely enrich our conversation. So thank you very much. Thank you everybody for being here.
Thank you.
And I'm looking forward to seeing you next week for our sad and difficult descent into the pit and slavery and brother turning against brother once more. Thank you. And Maxine, I'm passing the mic back to you.
Of course. Thank you so much for your insights as always. And I hope that everyone will join us next week. Later this week too. So enjoy the rest of the holiday and we'll see you soon. Thank you.
Chanukah Sameach, everybody.
Chanukah Sameach.
Happy holiday of light.
Chag Sameach.